Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of art, architecture, engineering, and planning. I'm your co-host, Eric Kessel, and I'm here with my co-host, Emiliano Gandolfi.
Hello.
We're beginning part two of our interview with Jonathan Kirschenfeld of the Institute of Public Architecture and Brenda Rosen of Breaking Ground on the subject of whether the right to housing is real. Last week, we had a fascinating discussion, and if you didn't listen to it, please visit our website at currystonedesignprize.com. Last week, we were discussing the conflicting roles of the public and private in addressing the problem of urban homelessness. Emiliano, where did we leave off?
There's another scale of the problem that is actually addressed very well by Breaking Ground, that is also looking at how some of these buildings can in fact function as rehabilitation schemes for a neighborhood or for a street that is actually undergoing some rough times. How can we see these buildings as an opportunity not only to house some people, but also to become a reference for a rehabilitation scheme for on a neighborhood level?
When Breaking Ground builds a building, we have multiple goals in mind. Obviously, as we've been discussing, we want to build something that is going to be sustainable and beautiful and give our tenants every opportunity to become stable, permanent residents that never fall back into homelessness again. But in addition to that, we want to always give back to the communities that we're building in and be a good neighbor. And that means that before we put a shovel in the ground, we are going to be meeting with every stakeholder that we can possibly meet with to find out what their needs are and what they're looking for in terms of uplifting the community and giving back and raising property values and doing more for the neighborhood. So I can give you a few examples of that. We have a building in downtown Brooklyn that actually was developed on a block that had two parking lots and really no retail. The street wasn't active at all. And we came in and developed a supportive housing building with more than 200 units of housing. But we did two other things. We built in a community accessory facility space, which essentially means that we are looking for a not-for-profit partner to come in and use that space, rent that space at a very, very low rent. And so in this building in Brooklyn, we have the Brooklyn Ballet, a not-for-profit ballet group, using that space for classes for children from toddlers on up to grown-ups. The reason that we specifically looked for somebody in the arts to use that space and do a program was because the building is in an area where people are always looking. It's a very artsy area, and people are looking for spaces to dance and rehearse and perform, and they can't always afford it. So we wanted to give back to the community, and so we brought in the Brooklyn Ballet, which again is a not-for-profit running classes that don't cost a lot for the neighborhood. And so that was one of the things. Inside that building, we actually have a black box theater that is as beautiful as any theater you'd find in the city. And we use that specifically to rent out at cost to community groups to do performances, to have rehearsals, and all sorts of other activities that they could otherwise not afford to do because renting out a theater can cost a lot of money. We also hold all of our tenant events, our dinners, and holiday events in this space. In another building in Brooklyn, in Brownsville, what we heard was that there was not a lot of community garden space and that people would like nice space to be able to sit in and potentially do some urban gardening and such. And we built a building that, again, is quite beautiful and has all of the design aspects that Jonathan's been talking about. But directly adjacent to the building, we have another 2,500 square foot space that we raised private funds for and developed into a neighborhood garden that the community asked for. And we are now growing tomatoes and everything you can think of, and holding yoga classes there to give back to the community. We specifically always try to show the community that we are not only going to be bringing in a building that may be replacing what was an abandoned space and potentially, you know, in an area that people were worried about and didn't want to go near. We're going to be bringing in a beautiful building there. We're going to be housing people that need housing, oftentimes from the community. So people that are homeless in that community will then have a home to move into. Supportive housing is a mixed model, so about 50% of the units are reserved for formerly homeless individuals, and 50% of the units are for low-income working individuals. So in kind of helping to give back to the community, we also give back affordable rents and beautiful apartments to low-income working people in that community, and then also have some sort of community aspect that we've developed as a direct result of what we're hearing from the constituents.
From my standpoint as an architect and someone very interested in the urban fabric, we've had the opportunity over the last 7 or 8 years to design and build 6 supportive housing buildings in a variety of neighborhoods in the Bronx and Brooklyn. But these are on sites that essentially are leftover sites. These are sites that for-profit developers have passed over because they are remnant sites, leftover sites, difficult sites, cannot maximize your floor area on these sites. And these are, ironically, the only sites that are affordable because they have been passed over, and not-for-profit agencies like Breaking Ground look for these kind of leftover or remnant parcels in order to shoehorn a number of apartments in a supportive housing building. What's interesting about supportive housing from that architectural and typological standpoint is that these buildings are filed, and I'm sorry to get a little technical, but they're filed as community facilities, not as residential buildings. And they're filed as community facilities because they are run by a not-for-profit developer, where there's a sense of, I would say, organization and control in terms of what happens in the building and how it happens and the kind of security within the building that is provided by the not-for-profit service provider. And when you design projects using the community facility rubric, you're allowed to reduce the standard courtyards that are part of the New York City zoning resolution. Reduce them from 1,200 square feet, meaning 30 by 40 minimum, to 20 by 30 a minimum. That's from 1,200 to 600 square feet. And while that may feel like we're taking a step backwards in terms of standards for housing, most of the good buildings that we know and love in New York that are social housing buildings from the 20s, 30s, and 40s do not have courtyards that are 30 by 40. This was really introduced in 1961 zoning, a resolution that changes to zoning, which ended up producing some rather awful buildings in New York that departed from the typologies that we know and love in New York City. So in an interesting way, first taking these remnant sites and having to do something with them provided us as a firm with a real challenge and a real puzzle. And that's what gives our work and gives our approach to this work a certain vitality. And they're more like buildings that we see around us, so that filling in these gaps in neighborhoods, similar in the way that Brenda's described connecting communities and making them whole by introducing these projects into the fabric. From the architectural standpoint, we feel that we're completing the neighborhood by building out to the street wall and providing courts and gardens for the residents and providing dignity not only for the residents but for the block. These are buildings that are beautiful. They don't look like low-cost housing. They look like buildings that you'd want to live in. And I think that, for us, is really the measure of success when we can build New York City housing that looks like New York City housing has always looked. And that goes all the way down to the choice of iron spot brick, which is the, I would say, ubiquitous and recognizable facade for so many great projects in Brooklyn and the Bronx throughout the five boroughs. It's an expensive brick, but as an architect, especially working for not-for-profits, we are given the control to make choices like that and to work with the program to maximize its impact for the residents and for New York City as a whole.
Thank you, Jonathan. It is interesting to ascertain how specific conditions that are generally seen as challenges can be used to generate interesting design solutions. And if integrated with what Brenda was saying about respecting a holistic view of the neighborhood, it shows a clear direction in which building supportive housing can become an opportunity to regenerate an urban area. We're taking a short break now. We will be right back to hear more from the CEO of Breaking Ground, Brenda Rosen, and from architect Jonathan Kirschenfeld. This is Social Design Insights, a show produced by the Curry Stone Design Prize. Please visit our website, currystonedesignprize.com, to learn more and follow us on Facebook and Twitter for all the updates on the podcast.
Welcome back to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. We've been discussing the issue of urban homelessness and various strategies for addressing it. Our distinguished guests today are Jonathan Kirschenfeld of the Institute of Public Architecture and Brenda Rosen of Breaking Ground. To you both, before the break, I had a thought.
You know, I've considered from time to time that in the neoliberal era, nonprofits and do-gooders function as a sort of market leader or market opener, and listening to both your stories, it sounds like in a New York context, both efforts are targeting properties that I think Jonathan referred to as leftover properties that, you know, were passed over by, you know, market-driven firms that would seek to develop something else. But with the style and quality of work that you all are producing, you're actually raising real estate prices, you're raising the desirability of that neighborhood. Do you ever worry that the downstream effects of this are essentially going to bring in market forces as opposed to creating real community?
From my standpoint, the idea of gentrification and displacement are really, really critical issues. And that's frankly one of the things that the Institute for Public Architecture is tackling and just recently tackled with our residency program out in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, that right now is undergoing that very pressure. Development is looming, and the folks that are in Sunset Park and throughout the boroughs, especially in areas that have a lot of manufacturing buildings, are potentially targets for rezoning. There has been a tremendous amount of resistance, and rightfully so, to the idea of folks now coming in to kind of sweep up the product of years and years and years of hard work by working class folks, by community groups who have managed to hold on, preserve what they've got, stabilize their neighborhoods. And now suddenly they're being eyed as ripe for brand new slick towers and an inrush of folks who really change the character of the neighborhood and, frankly, push up the real estate values to the extent that the folks who have stuck it out for all those years can't afford to live there anymore. So it's a tremendous concern, and this is something we all have to be very, very smart about, aware of, not something that gets swept under the rug. This is something we need to face as a design community, as a development community, and figure out how to build affordable housing without creating this kind of backlash and resentment and tension between folks who live in neighborhoods and folks who are moving into neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add that I think that at the end of the day, you know, New York has grown by over a million people in the last several years, and there is just an enormous need for housing. And to that end, I think that the city is being very creative and innovative about looking to rezone and looking to do things like mandatory inclusionary housing. You know, I think that there are a lot of terrific things going on to try to address and acknowledge that we need to keep developing and that we need to figure out how to fit in affordable housing in the mix. I mean, for us, for Breaking Ground, you know, our goal is to bring affordable and supportive housing to our community. We don't do market rate housing, and to help the community in, you know, as many ways as possible to make them feel better about their block, about their area. So, you know, one other example that came to mind while I was listening was that we developed a building in the South Bronx several years ago. And one of the issues that the neighbors were dealing with was loitering on the corners and drug dealing. We always have very expansive security systems in our buildings, and we have exterior and interior cameras. And what we were able to do was to pay some more attention to the building across the street, actually two different buildings across the street in two different directions, using our camera system. And we have 24-hour security, so we were able to monitor what was going on both in our property and also really keep an eye on what was going on across the street. And because we work with so many community stakeholders and work with the police precincts and the community boards and resident and tenant groups, we were able to provide information, you know, in real time about what was going on. And, you know, 6 months after we kind of all started working together, there weren't people loitering and doing what they had been doing in front of those other buildings any longer. I suppose, you know, one of the unintended consequences that we all fear is that as you're turning a neighborhood around and you're using every bit of land that you possibly can to develop on and really bring new services to the area, et cetera, that, you know, it becomes more popular and other people start looking at those areas and think about building. And then all of a sudden you have the problem of people worrying about whether they're going to be able to stay in their homes because property values have gone up. I think what we all have to do is acknowledge that is a real concern and look to build in other requirements and strategies to ensure that affordable housing remains affordable and that as people are developing market rate and other housing in the areas, that affordable and supportive housing has to be in the mix. And to that end, the city is putting out RFPs now, requests for proposals, for city-owned land, and we're seeing that they are asking for proposals that include mixed-use housing and retail space and community facility space to really use these pieces of property to bring in services and a really integrated developments where there are people that have almost no income up to market rate housing. And I think that those are all really great initiatives on the part of the city.
Brenda, I'd like to ask you, as a not-for-profit, are you invited, are you interested, and does your mission allow for you to do mixed housing that includes market rate units?
Our mission is not to build market rate. We are doing both supportive and standalone affordable housing now. We are getting ready to open our first standalone 100% affordable building up in the Bronx with 248 units of low-income family housing to the neighborhood alongside a more traditional supportive housing building. And again, that was in response to what the community was looking for. They said we need larger apartments for families. And so in this particular affordable building that we're doing with 248 units, more than 50% of the units are going to be 2- and 3-bedroom apartments, which is what was asked for. Market rate, I don't see that happening anytime soon. But as we respond to RFPs with other developers as a larger development team, there are opportunities to have 4 and 5 buildings, and some of them focus more on supportive and some moderate and middle and some market rate. So no, I don't see Breaking Ground doing that, but we are looking at opportunities to be part of those larger development teams.
In a mix of a for-profit and not-for-profit development team, who's calling the shots? And at least in my experience, it's always the for-profit developer who is calling the shots, and the not-for-profit developer has a role, clearly. But I would like in the future to see that reversed somehow, where a mission-based not-for-profit is able to take on a for-profit developer as a sub in some way, but that the leading developer is a not-for-profit developer, because I think in the end that will produce much better mixed-use building.
I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, on the supportive housing end, what's really fantastic about it is that when you're developing supportive housing using city funds, the not-for-profit is the lead entity,
right,
and you can have a joint venture with a for-profit, but the not-for-profit must be the lead entity. And I think that that's very important because Breaking Ground has so much experience in this area. When we're talking about being part of a larger team, I think that we're particularly good at negotiating a presence such that we have a say in how things are going to be developed and what we're looking for to make sure it meets our standards for what our tenants need. But I couldn't agree more that I think that having the not-for-profit have a larger role and potentially taking a lead role would be incredibly beneficial.
So we should definitely send this podcast to the administration or, of New York City, of the New York City State, because I think that actually New York really paved the way for many decades on a great tradition on affordable and social housing. So I think it is time now maybe to look back at that tradition and create a new tradition of affordability in a city that actually has a quite different condition now. I just wanted to thank again very much Jonathan and Brenda for this conversation. I think it was very insightful, and you both are doing work that is creating great inspiration. It's maybe not addressing completely the challenges that the city of New York and the country are facing, but I think they're really showing a direction in which these challenges could be faced. So thank you very much, and I hope this conversation will actually go on directly with the new projects. And I invite everybody to look at and follow the Institute for Public Architecture, that is the organization that Jonathan founded to actually bring attention on some of these topics, and follow the work, of course, of Breaking Ground.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. We'd like to thank our guests of the last 2 weeks, Jonathan Kirschenfeld of the Institute for Public Architecture and Jonathan Kirschenfeld Architects, and Brenda Rosen of Breaking Ground. We hope you've enjoyed this two-part series. Social Design Insights is a program of the Curry Stone Foundation and the Curry Stone Design Prize. For further information, please look us up on the web at currystonedesignprize.com. There you'll find links to both Jonathan and Brenda's work and full galleries of their projects and useful links for further research. Also, please don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Instagram for all the latest news on social design.